Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today is Tuesday, February 23rd. We have Jayant Bhandari and Ira Harris today. Jayant is constantly traveling the world to look for investment opportunities. He regularly meets with mining companies in the natural resources sector. He advises institutional investors about his findings. He was a director on the board of Gold Canyon, a publicly listed Canadian company. And he earlier also worked for 6 years with US Global Investors out of San Antonio, Texas. Before emigrating from India, he started and ran Indian subsidiary operations of two European companies. And he's written extensively throughout various publications internationally. Ira is an independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003, and a stint most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us, Richard.
Yes, thank you, Richard. This is, as usual, wonderful, and thanks for providing the platform. It's great. So
great. Yeah, and Jayant is joining us today from Singapore. What is your view on the macro, the global macro, Jayant, in terms of like the economy and the financial markets?
Well, Richard, it's interesting because everything seems to be on technical basis these days. US economy is doing better, it seems that the end result is that there is a fall in the US stock market. And this is a very strange thing, really, from a fundamental perspective. US dollar clearly became very expensive by the end of later part of last year. And there was a fall in the value of US dollar at some point of time. But I think US dollar has probably seen its peak already, and there is a correction. Now, I'm not a currency trader, by the way, but still I invest in the stock market. I invest internationally, and these are very important things for me because I see the technical aspects of the US dollar, the desperation among people for liquidity, and the US dollar driving the market.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, I begin my analysis with currencies, and I make the same view. And ahead, I thought last when dollar yen got to 151, I thought that was an absolutely preposterous thing, and that we were going to see major changes because of that. And I think we have, and we see more and more that there's onshoring to Japan, especially in the chip sector. So we are starting to see some maneuvering, but you had euro yen still hanging around up at 145, and it's not like Europe doesn't have many. It has some great hurdles that it's facing, and the Japanese are certainly going to change some aspect of monetary policy as we get a new head of the BOJ. So I happen to agree with you quite a bit, Jayant, that. The dollar got way too strong. It's now where we're sitting at this morning. We're at 104.5 using the dollar index, which, for lack of a better vehicle, we are forced to use. But amazingly, emerging markets are holding up pretty well. But that's because they raced out in front of the Fed and all the other central banks, lifting their interest rates dramatically because they were aware and felt the pain of too strong a dollar. So they could not afford. They have a 1998, 1994, many, many years. And of course, I'm old enough when I was doing my academic work to go back to the 70s and to see some of that fallout, especially after the 73 war and oil prices racing higher and the impact on the economy. So your point to me is spot on.
And to that end, Jayant, what do you make of investing in the emerging markets? Do you see opportunities like in the Southeast Asian countries or even in China? I think you mentioned in a recent podcast that you hold equities in China.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm actively investing in China. I think Chinese stock market continues to be cheap. Now, among the emerging markets, that's the only emerging market I see. I see China as the only place where I see development happening among all the third poor countries. And I'm very much a fan of East Asia from the economic point of view, because these are very stable currencies, which lead to very stable currencies as well. And as you can see, Hong Kong dollar and Singaporean dollar, and I'm currently in Singapore, are backed by, maybe not physical gold, but they are backed by something more real than what other currencies are backed by, which is that Hong Kong dollar is backed by real US dollars and Singaporean dollar is backed by a multiple currencies. So, I'm very, very optimistic about East Asia.
And do you do the investing on the Chinese equities through the Hong Kong stock market? Is that?
That's what I think is the easiest way. And also it's one of the cheaper ways. And I don't know, Richard, where I read of you somewhere, but what I have seen is that value investing is becoming an important aspect of the investment world today. This is no longer going to be trading for trends anymore, I think, over the medium term.
Mm-hmm. Interesting observation. Your thoughts, Ira?
Well, again, I agree. And when we speak of East Asia, I have turned, it's been a long time, bullish on Japanese financial institutions. Because if these changes that we're talking about and seeing in Asia, and especially East Asia, and there is, even before COVID, there was starting to be movement, some movement out of China, because China labor costs were going up fairly dramatically. And more importantly, I mean, I'm sitting here right now, and one of the most important currency correlations and relationships is the Japanese yen to the yuan, because this has moved. This is a very important political relationship. And I say that because we go back to the 90s. And when Bill Clinton made that trip to Beijing in June of 1998, prior to his going there, or right 2 days before going there, the United States actually intervened to drive the yen higher upon that trip, because the Chinese were really struggling with a 2-week yen as they were trying to build up their industrial sector. And let's face it, Japan is a high quality, highly engineered. And that's what the Chinese are striving for. And back then, I believe the level got to about 20 and a half yen to a yuan. And then when they intervened and changed, and it was a real political message, because of course, Clinton didn't go to Japan. And the Japanese were none too happy. And you're in Singapore, and I've read some of the things that Lee Kuan Yew wrote about it, and who is better at understanding that world than him? I mean, he advised to many, many people. So that's a relationship, and we're right back there. I mean, we're not at 20 and a half, but we did get there earlier in the year, and then of course, the yen started to strengthen, and I don't think that was a mistake in any way, shape, or form. Now, where it'll go from here, I don't know. It'll depend on what the Japanese do here. And there is some talk, but I talked to a very knowledgeable person in Japan about if they're going to put a VAT tax on in order to pay for a lot of the programs that Kishida is looking at. But he was skeptical about that, about a VAT tax. So if the Japanese start to raise interest rates, I think East Asia becomes even that much more interesting.
What do you make, Jayant, of the currency markets in like Southeast Asia, particularly like the Thai baht, Malaysian ringgit, Singapore dollar, Indonesian rupiah?
You know, a lot of these currencies compared to the US dollar are cheap. And I quite enjoy matching my traveling experience with what the MacBurger index of The Economist says and what the PPP to nominal GDP ratio tells me about. And I think that is where Singaporean dollar, Hong Kong dollar, Japanese currency, and even South Korean currency and Taiwanese currency feel very relatively cheap. I think they are about 30% cheaper than they should be in the US dollar, because you still get top-notch services and top-notch quality in these countries. So these are not third world countries, so they should not be 30 to 40% cheaper than the US. And that's what tells me consistently that the US dollar is expensive. But the thing is that the market trades on technical basis, and certainly it is trading on technical basis right now. And if the US Fed raises interest rate, again, US dollar will become expensive. Then, of course, over a period of time, something has to change.
Mm-hmm. Now, on that basis, would it make sense to consider, especially like resource countries, as China reopens up, Malaysia, you know, oil, sort of palm oil companies or energy companies, Malaysia, Indonesia, agriculture, right, in Thailand, do those make sense for potential investment asset classes?
Well, for me, one thing that certainly makes a huge sense is metallurgical coal. Metallurgical coal was cheap, and China is back in action, and metallurgical coal companies are trading at a massive discount to their inherent value, from what I see.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, your thoughts, Ira?
I just finished reading a book, The World for Sale, and I actually lived through so much of that. And you know what? I'm not a stock picker. I'm a top down stock picker because of all the things that we're sitting here talking about. So I see macro changes, whether they're interest rates, whether they're growth prospects. Of course, 2019, 2020 was important because the Chinese broke the traditional way of looking at them, because as the world started to slow down, the yuan didn't go weaker, which would have been everybody was looking for that response. But the yuan actually strengthened, which told me, in the Michael Pettis view of the world, and I think that's right, as China moves to a more consumer-based economy, as they are middle class, and that's what a middle class economy. So their savings rates would, of course, drop, but that means that their demand for raw materials would take place, and the stronger currency was used for that. The Chinese stockpiled massive amounts of copper when copper was down in the $2, $2.50 area. So they did phenomenally well with that. I mean, that's the way that I view the world in taking it down. So I agree with Gian that I look for companies like that. And I'm really amazed that the Chinese don't try to come out and purchase and buy something like Glencore, because Glencore has such a massive footprint for everything that they do and need over a long-term basis. You know, there are some really high quality companies out there. So I 100% in agreement with the way that Giant sees this. And I'm my footprint is trying to go the same way. And I know that when we've talked to others, because we did a recent podcast with Louis Gavet, and we discussed these same things. So I'm 100% in your camp. I see that. And I see the move away to quote unquote value companies, but you have to search for those value companies and look at them. You know, we buy the move to ETFs. You're like a personal insurance company, and I get the safety of it, but I buy a lot of lousy companies coupled with a few good companies. So why don't I just go out and search for those quality companies?
Yeah. What about in China or at the Hong Kong stock market giant? Which asset class or sectors do you like?
Just about everything I look in the Hong Kong stock market these days looks cheap to me. The property companies are very cheap because they got sold off because of fear in the market. And again, this is, when fear kicks in, people just sell off some of these kinds of companies. There was a huge amount of fear related with properties in China. So now they are trading for, you know, some of those companies are trading for a discount of 80% to the market valuation of the properties those companies own. They have got sold off. As I said, metallurgical coal is probably one of the most beaten down sector. And there's another reason why it's so beaten down, because the coal ETF that used to exist no longer exists. Sovereign funds and institutional investors sold their ownership of coal companies. And the end result has been that there are just no buyers for those companies, except that they offer fabulous valuations. I think Chinese banks look interesting to me. I don't own a lot of them because it's very hard to understand balance sheets of banks. But as long as I'm still getting 7 to 8, 9% dividend every year consistently, I'm reasonably okay owning a small portion of banks in these countries. So yeah, across the board, I see good valuation in Chinese companies, but you have to be very careful because you don't want to invest in scam-based companies in Hong Kong Stock Exchange.
Yeah, exactly. And Ira, what are your feeling on Chinese equities in Hong Kong? Are you comfortable with that? Or would prefer to do it more indirectly?
That's not really a place where, as I say, mm-hmm. I, as an investor, the way that I look at the world, I can do better on the peripherals. So when Jian says, well, you know, metallurgical coal, so now I look at Australia, or I'll look around maybe some Indian, you know, India is very active in the coal markets, and we've had things turned on its head. And I think that the valuations are there, especially because of the flaws in ESG investing, which is, you know, right now all the rage in certain sectors. So, you know, you watch Warren Buffett and he gobbles up companies as others dispose of them for non-financial reasons, but for more, as some would say, virtual signaling that we're doing the right things. And there are high quality companies to be had. But you and where I start with, and I don't know the way Yant does, but I look to see who's paying down debt as they're making money. It's a highly critical point for me. And then to see how they're positioned and how I think the world's going to go. So if I look at Japanese financials, I mean, for 8 years, I've sat in Mitsubishi Tokyo. It's a terrible investment, except that it's like owning a bond, because as Jan said, it pays me for these 8 years, 4, 4.5, 3.5, 5% dividends. While I sit and wait, and now the bank, the stock price has moved up. But then you dig through them, and they own 22% of Morgan Stanley. Well, Morgan Stanley is one of the best performing, probably the best performing U.S. bank at this juncture. They've outperformed Goldman because they threw away the Goldman platform of trying to be a hedge fund posing as a bank. And they've actually gotten back to just like UBS. I'm wildly bullish on UBS because they went back and started to do wealth management and what people really need. And UBS has a big footprint in Asia. And I'm wondering when that 22%, that's what I keep looking at, of Morgan Stanley that is owned by Tokyo Mitsubishi, starts to really synchronize these things and to get and when does Morgan Stanley up its footprint in Asia using that facility? I mean, look at Tokyo Mitsubishi. It's just been saddled with a terrible situation being in Japan, and they were one who suffered from the deflation. But I 100% agree with this assessment. But it takes a lot of work. If you think this is easy, it's not easy.
Speaking of India, what are your thoughts, Jayant, on investing in India? I think you mentioned you had some concerns in a recent podcast. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, I am extremely negative on India, Richard. Everything that can go wrong is going wrong in that country. And I know the international media does not present what's happening in India these days. But for example, this morning, one politician said a couple of bad words for the prime minister. They sent a whole regiment of paramilitary troops to arrest him from a plane. He was sitting inside the plane. With machine guns. So what's happening in that country is scary. It's truly falling apart. And look at this company Adani that has, which has become a big problem in the Indian stock market recently. But I used to follow Indian portfolio of one boutique firm at one point of time, and Indian valuations are extremely high and very suspicious. I'm very suspicious about what they present to you in their balance sheets. Mm-hmm.
And in your travels, perhaps meetings with mining companies, what are you hearing like on for industrial metals, or are there any trends that you see?
Well, there has been limited traveling, Richard, strangely. I've traveled a lot, but not much to mining companies recently. They have been, they have this COVID protocol, and they did not really want too many investors visiting their projects. So I've traveled a lot, but not to mining companies much. There is clearly several issues to do with mining these days. Getting hold of spare parts is a problem. There has been cost inflation. There has to be an increase in price of many of the commodities. And we did see a nice jump in pricing of a lot of commodities when the war started between Russia and Ukraine. But a lot of those prices have fallen back to normal, which means that the war had a transitionary effect on pricing, but they have come back to normal. So we'll see, but I think what I'm looking at is what happens with China over the next few months. Are they able to pick up growth again, or they will stumble along for a while before they pick up growth?
How does it look like now in China on the reopening?
Well, I going to China is not possible right now. I have a 10-year tourist visa for China. That's how I have always gone to China. And on a tourist visa, I cannot enter China right now. So I prefer to smell the street. I want to see the mood in the coffee shops. I want to walk around to get a feel for the energy of the crowd. And I don't have that feel right now. But having said that, Richard, I'm extremely bullish about, I spent a fair bit of my time in Japan recently, about 2 months back. Extremely bullish on the energy that is in East Asia, the optimism, passion that people have to do better in these countries. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's interesting. Great. Your thoughts, Ira?
No, I'm following Jayant's lead because I don't know those things. Now, I do know somebody who goes to Japan quite a bit, and we don't talk in those veins. So I'm just left watching a huge amount of CapEx in Japan. The third quarter saw a record CapEx. Because first of all, Japanese companies with a weak yen, and I still make what the yen is 135, it's still a weak yen relative, to my history when I started trading foreign currencies. Dollar yen was 360. And for many, many years, it was down 75 to 85 in that realm. And which led to a huge outflow. That's the history of capitalism. When your currency really starts to take off, you become a major investor in all kinds of economies. And globalization was a great thing for the Japanese. It hollowed out a lot of Japanese companies, but Japan has massive investments around the world. Foreign direct investment for Japan is, which is why when people used to watch the so-called risk on, risk off trade. The world has got all kinds of problems. What was the yen doing? Rallying. Well, why was it rallying? Because Japanese companies were busy bringing home a lot of money that they were letting outside the country. First of all, it was earning a lot more, and they were making, a lot of money. So they would bring the money home. I know you're not seeing that as much, but they can at the flip of a switch. I mean, anytime that they want to move the currency, the Japanese can move the currency through either Norichukin, through the government pension investment fund, the Japanese insurance company. There's enormous efforts. And I think that Japan sees itself getting some of the outflow from China as a stable and reliable, of course. I mean, this is what we've seen. This is what Japan has been. So I'm really bullish on Japan. It doesn't mean that they won't have their ups and downs. They will, as we try to figure out where monetary policy is going. But unlike the U.S., the Chinese domestics own about 95% of the bond market. So good, bad, or indifferent, you're not harming international investors. When you, just like Japanese, everybody got the Japanese bond market wrong, including myself, in the 90s, because Japan was in actual deflation. And even though those policies looked ridiculous, if you were a Japanese bondholder, which at that time, they owned 97% of the market, you were getting real yields of 2.5%. Because you had real deflation, which we've never had here, by the way. We've never had real deflation since the 30s. Everybody thinks you have, but the central banks will not, in my estimation. And if you listen to Bernanke, when he was in and he's really set this policy, will not allow it. So I'm all those things I feel, and I think Japan is a very, very interesting place. And don't forget, everybody looks at equity markets, the high in the Nikkei, and I know the index has changed dramatically, so the makeup of it is far different, but the Nikkei was at 40,000 in 1989. It struggles at 27,000 here, and we've been down to 7,000, so it has never recouped. Now, there might be good reason for that, but if you look at Japanese corporate balance sheets, they're pretty healthy.
Yeah. Before we get into the geopolitical issues in Asia and Europe, just you were mentioning before we started the podcast on the Middle East, how it's opening up. Can you elaborate on that? Like, what investment opportunities make potential sense in your estimation?
So, Richard, I think I go to the Middle East a couple of times a year. I have not been there for a couple of years, though. But, there is a lot of money and people, good, smart people moving to the Middle East. Dubai actually has become very popular, not just with people, for people with money, but also professional IT people. They want to move to Dubai because Dubai is now offering these people infrastructure to set up IT companies and other high technology businesses. Now, how far that will go, I don't know, but the initial signs are very good. While people living far away from the Middle East like to paint everything in the Middle East with the same brush, some of the most safe places on the world are in the Middle East. Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Muscat, Bahrain, they are very safe and good places. Very interestingly, Saudi Arabia recently opened up itself for investments in mining. Mm. Now, from what I have seen, this is something very unique. Barrick Gold recently invested money there, and I think either Anglo-American or Anglo-Gold Ashanti invested in a project in Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia is now inviting people to come and invest in their country.
Wow. Your thoughts, Ira?
Well, the Middle East, as we were talking about before, and I was rereading in a blog I wrote in 2017, things changed prior to, of course, even Ukraine invasion, when in October of 2017, the Saudi king actually went to Moscow. And I thought that was a big thing. So there are structural changes that have been taking place. And one of the critical ones, I think, and you're starting to see it, is the Arab-Israeli situation. where you have Arab nations and United Arab Emirates and others who have sat down and reached certain agreements with the Israelis, who they view as a motor of huge economic dynamicism. So that has changed quite a bit, and it changed the structure and the discussion, because all of the geopolitics of the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, when it came to the Middle East, 2000, 2010, was that whatever was going to take place for stability was going to go through the Palestinian situation. And they've turned that on their heads, for good, bad, or, but that's just the way it is. And it's interesting when you watch geopolitical voices, they're as stupid as academic economists who get married to a model and won't change when the situation changes. You know, Keynes's famous words, you know, when the facts change, so do I. What do? And it prevails, because when that changes, are you going to hold to that old model? And I think we're seeing things change. And there's one thing that I always, whenever I teach the classes, if you're involved in global macro and you are static in your thinking and your modeling, you have no chance. Right. This is the beauty of global macro. This is why I fell in love with it in the 70s. And I continue to thrive in this area, because I love it so much, because it's so dynamic. Mm-hmm. And if you don't change with it, you're a fool. And it really, but academics are allowed to be fools, because they don't have skin in the game. The skin is their model, so they'll marry to a model. So I think Jean's view is 100% correct. And we're seeing it with the Russian oil too. So there are movements afoot, and you better change with them.
And for if we go into looking at geopolitical issues or risks to the economy, the global economy, and the financial markets happening in Europe and in Asia, what are your thoughts on that, Jayant?
As I said, I'm extremely pessimistic about the Indian subcontinent area. Pakistan currently has a massive currency crisis. They have an economic crisis, and that will result into an increasing social crisis as well. So I completely exclude South Asia's Indian subcontinent from my thinking as far as investing or doing anything is concerned. I don't know what the result of this war will be, because, you know, we have become so polarized. One side says that Russia is winning. Another side says that Ukraine is winning. And I can't decide between the two sets of information. And as Mr. Harris correctly said, you have to give up your arrogance when you want to invest in the markets, because I can't side with one side just because I prefer that side to win. So I don't know the outcome of that, but I certainly think that the US dollar is going to peak with the peaking of the interest rate in the US dollar, and then very likely a downdrift in the US dollar valuation will start. And that will probably not be very good for the US dollar, because a lot of countries are already talking about using alternative currencies instead of US dollar. And so at the fringe, if things start to change for the US dollar, it's a lot of cash from around the world can start flooding back to the US, and that won't be good for the US dollar.
Mm-hmm. Your thoughts, Aaron?
Where the dollar plays out here in the long term, well, I'm not even going to talk about long term because it's such a nebulous phrase. The dollar has some serious issues, but because you're the world's reserve currency, that's what I would call, and I always call, the third mandate of the Fed. And you can run and hide from it, but you really can't, because especially as we deal, Megan Green wrote a piece in the FT yesterday about the Hotel California. I don't know if Jayant understands that it is is familiar with that, but that comes from the song of the group, of the rock and roll group, the Eagles, you know, and they're caught, and the banks are caught because they created, again, based on their models and the creation of QE, and they're caught in this role. But with that, QE led into massive amounts of global leveraging. And that's what they, and that's, and the Fed has, it may not be a domestic mandate, but foreign policy, as we see with the way they use sanctions, that's a mandate, because the entire global system is based on the necessity of dollar liquidity in the system. And when you squeeze it too tight, just like they did, you saw it in 2022 when the dollar went too high, when the Fed got out in front of the other central banks and started squeezing, and then they started doing some quantitative tightening, you start to uncover how much risk exists in the global system. And with that, and the Fed is aware of it, which is why, of course, they put into the standing repo facility, which if I do my math right, I can, they have a way to lever that up to about $2 trillion if they needed to. But it tells you the stronger dollar was starting to choke the global system so badly when we got up to the dollar index of 113, 114, 112, it was really destructive. So they have to be attuned to that. And to me, that puts a ceiling on why they will pause quicker than people think. You know, they keep talking about this inflation, but then you all of a sudden you get Powell, who at the last meeting and in his sit down, of course, with David Rubenstein, disinflation, you know, and that word was carefully used by him. So it's going to pause faster. I don't care what these Fed members, when they come out and speak on CNBC or Bloomberg, and they talk about, well, 50 base. First of all, both of those were non-voters. So you can have an opinion, but your opinion doesn't carry much weight. And I didn't see any dissenting votes. The vote was unanimous. So all this talk that takes place after the fact, to me, is just that talk, and it's filling the airwaves and newspapers with, you know, the space that has to be filled. But the dollar will play an important role, and the Fed cannot relinquish that role. They're as tied up into it as anybody else.
And speaking of currencies, you mentioned earlier, Jayant, on the alternative currencies. The final question, do you see an emerging division for alliance between countries following the Belt and Road Forum? The Belt and Road Initiative, which transformed into the Belt and Road Forum countries versus World Economic Forum countries, and how that factors into currencies.
I think Ira in a way responded to that question, and the response is that there is so much solid fundamentals and power behind the US dollar that other currencies actually don't stand a chance to become international currencies. And maybe he can disagree with me on that, but I think US dollar is the international currency. It will stay the international currency. And other people who want to replace their currency with US dollar will actually mostly fail. The only thing is that US dollar at one point of time will become so expensive that people who struggle to get hold of US dollar will actually no longer chase it because it will have become so expensive. So that's my only fear about the US dollar. And I think once the interest rate peaks, it might peak the US dollar at the same time. But as far as responding specifically to your question is concerned, I don't think there's a competitor for the US dollar coming for several decades. Mm.
Great, interesting. And your final thoughts, Ira?
I'll disagree with that somewhat, because I think the ability is there, but it's not easy. It'll be a tough, and it'll take major missteps by the U.S. Is the U.S. capable of major missteps? Yes, I can look at monetary and fiscal policy and say, yes, they are capable of major missteps. Do I want it to happen? Absolutely not, because the system, the years of a U.S., as Charles Kindleberger would talk about, a hegemon, a systemic hegemon is necessary. and it's not easy to replace. So that's 100% right. But, you know, I see what goes on. And so those missteps, and part of those missteps is the use of the dollar as a weapon. I think the U.S. overplays that. I thought that they overplayed it for five decades in my thinking. So, and they do it more and more because they get more and more confident in it. And again, it's a way to squeeze what they believe is squeezing people without actually having to put boots on the ground or jets in the air and that they could bring people to heel. I think you have to be careful with it, because when you overplay that, it's like with anything else, it loses its credibility. And again, countries know how to move or manipulate around this. Right now, and Jan probably, I'm sure, knows far more about it than I am. I'm just really learning about it. All the ghost ships that are around the world moving Russian oil, you know, that come from different places, especially places in the Mideast. So people adjust. You know, you don't bring them to heel quite as much as you think. And I think you put a little chink in your armor. So how long it continues, I don't know. Are the Chinese in a position to supplant? Not at all, because you have to have respect for the rule of law, number one. I think that's, you know, and it has to be a good store of value. Now, I think the yuan has been very stable over quite a long period of time. So it is gaining more acceptance. And then there are some who are using it, like the Russians, in their reserves, just as a way to tweak the U.S. So you're seeing a little bit of that, but those numbers are inconsequential at this time. But it'll depend more on U.S. policy, I think, than anything else, as people will quietly move away. We've seen it before. And then U.S. policy regathers. I mean, the 70s, after Nixon pulled the U.S. off the gold standard and the end of Bretton Woods, so to speak, and the gold exchange system. So again, it's a very dynamic and fluid situation, which will be prone to good policy and to bad policy. And let's hope that the good policy, again, in the Kindleberger world with the global hegemon, as he said, hegemonic stability theory, I think is very important, and the world craves it. We don't want the monetary system to break down. It would be a major disaster for everybody.
Yeah. Well, great. That's been a fascinating discussion. Just, Jayant, how can our listeners and viewers learn more about your work and your thoughts, writings?
Everything I do goes on my website, jayantbhandari.com. Mm-hmm.
Great. And Ira?
I'm not writing as much as I was. And that's because the situation, so much of it that I write, we have not seen the major changes yet. And war, you know, wars are one thing and they do create change, but those changes take place over time. It's like people, you know, I read yesterday where people say, oh, on the outbreak of, you know, global violence, wars, buy gold. I'm telling you never buy gold. You can trade it on the outbreak of violence, but if you think that it's no, and I have the scars to prove it, because for all the years when I would, oh, there's an outbreak, meaning gold is a monetary phenomenon, as a store of value, as a haven. It is, when it comes to war, it's just, it's not. You will buy that spike and you will get hurt. So I don't do that. Gold has its place in people's portfolio, but as a monetary phenomenon. So, you know, this provides me and people who follow me a great opportunity. It's the fact that I can sit here and talk to Jayant, it doesn't get better than that. And these are really good. And again, the Financial Repression Authority really does a great service for people who want to learn. I had a friend of mine from grammar school call me or send me an email the other day. And actually we talked because he listens to the podcast and he had a question about the FDIC that he saw. I said, yeah, well, sure, we could talk about it. And I said, and he apologized for taking my time. I said, no, this is what you want to do. You want to learn. You had a question. Yeah. You're 70 years old. You want to protect your wealth and do better going forward. These things will teach you. you don't get this kind of opportunity to sit and listen to somebody like John talk about these things. So these are great. And thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Jayant and Ira. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.